You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.
Hello and welcome to this week's Times Higher Education issue review covering the period 18th to 24th of February 2016. I'm reporter David Matthews and I'm joined by reporters Jack Grove and Chris Havergal and books editor Karen Shook. So in this week's issue, we've got an analysis on big pension changes that could leave academics up to £100 per month out of pocket. The cost at their university is hundreds of millions of pounds. Jack's got the latest on that. This week's lead feature is on how academics can manage a seemingly overwhelming workload. We've got advice from six academics on that. Chris has an interview with a former Deputy Vice-Chancellor of the University of Bradford, who's now leading a university in Amman. And Karen's got this week's roundup of all our latest book reviews. But first, Jack, so there's two overlapping pension changes coming in April, and this could cost academics quite dearly.
Yes, this is two things that sort of come together in April. One is the changes to the university superannuation scheme, which is the biggest provider of pensions in the sector. And then on top of that, you're going to have changes around the national state pension. And basically, it's going to mean quite a lot of money for a lot of people. Someone earning £46,000 a year which is quite a sort of typical academic salary for someone who's been in the scheme for a few years. They will be more than £1,000 off, worse off each year. So that's about £100 a month. And so I'm always trying to get people interested in university pensions. It's not the most sort of sexy subject, but
doing a good job.
But this is actually going to hit people quite hard in the pocket. I mean, £1,000. That's the that's a cost of a family holiday or, the cost of running a car for a year. So it could really have quite an impact on quite a few academics.
And the national insurance contribution, that will affect everyone, will it?
It will
affect... Not just academics.
It will affect more people than academics, but it will only affect people who are in defined benefit pension schemes. So me and you, David, we won't be affected by it.
Aren't we the lucky ones?
That's why our pension schemes are not as different, generous. They're different. Yes. So we won't be hit by that. Academics will be, academics and university staff. So they'll be hit both by the changes to the USS pension scheme, which means they'll possibly be getting less in the future, and they'll also be paying more at the moment, and then there's the national insurance situation where they'll be paying more as well.
Yeah, it's and actually the people suffering from this, they're almost the lucky ones, because new people don't even get these pension schemes, is that right?
No, everyone will be paying more. It will all just depend on how long you've been in the scheme, what part of the scheme you're in. Not everyone will lose £100 a month. Some people will pay less, but depending.
No one's going to gain from this. But I take it.
Probably not.
Right. Okay. But it's also going to cost universities quite a lot.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to hit staff, but universities potentially will be hit harder in that the employer contribution will go up to 18%, which is quite high if you compare that to other schemes. Mm-hmm. So going up from 16% to 18%, that's going to cost a lot of money. The national insurance alone is going to cost £200 million for the whole sector. And so potentially that might affect the pay negotiations coming up. They're going to come up if the university is having to pay 4 to 5% more in a year. They might say, you have to tighten the belts a bit. We don't know, but
yet again.
Possibly.
Yeah, because I guess it comes after years of below inflation pay rises, so it's another sort of real terms decrease for academic
wages. Well, it's not even a real terms decrease, it is actually a big decrease for a lot of people.
Well, it's an absolute
really unpleasant decrease, let's put it that way.
Well, that's a jolly note to begin on. In our main feature this week, it's probably also not a good idea if you're an aspiring academic to read this, it's all about how you can manage seemingly unmanageable workloads and, you know, reclaim your weekends and what used to be your free time. We've got six academics giving their opinions on how you can do this. One of the best ones is one who, Harriet Bulkeley from Durham University, who set up a group called Opportunities Anonymous. It's essentially academics who couldn't say no to new opportunities. And they kind of they try to remind each other that opportunities do have costs down the line. They do end up taking a lot of your time. So one slogan they came up with included, "All baby opportunities are cute. Imagine this opportunity as a teenager." There's also another rather grim quote from someone who says, "A key purpose of a PhD is to destroy a young person's ability to enjoy leisure." What they mean by this is, once you become an academic, you know, either your research is at the front of your mind or it's the back of your mind. But they do have some tips over how you might be able to cut down on your workload. Now, Chris, you've interviewed a academic with a rather unusual career trajectory. He's gone from Bradford to Amman.
Yes, this is very much a case of an Englishman abroad. This is Barry Wynne. He was Deputy Vice-Chancellor of the University of Bradford. Probably over the last decade or so, there's been a number of senior UK academics who've gone to work in the Middle East, but we'd often think of them going to places like the United Arab Emirates or Qatar. Barry Wynne has gone to be Vice-Chancellor of Amman's first private university, that's called Soha University, and I spoke to him at our MENA University Summit, which was held in UAE earlier this month. It's a very interesting conversation, not least just to discuss his views on UK universities' attitude to internationalisation and why it was that he decided to work abroad in the first place. And he is basically, he's been talking about his views about internationalisation for a long time, and now he needs to walk the walk. What he says that he thinks many UK universities have taken what he describes as a colonial approach to internationalisation, basically being focused on bringing students from around the world to the UK, saying, you know, this is our model of education, it's the best, you know, enjoy it or leave it. Whereas he thinks actually you need a much more of a conversation between cultures, and students and academics working abroad is a big part of that. So he says that when the opportunity came up to go to Amman, he couldn't really say no.
Okay. I mean, when people talk about, you know, colonial attitudes to higher education when they're collaborating, I sometimes wonder whether British academics do sort of slip into a slight cultural relativism sometimes. I mean, he said, you know, you go to Amman and there's a different attitude to freedom of speech. And what did he say there?
Yeah, it's certainly a difficult one for all universities and academics who've gone to work in the Middle East in recent years, you know, different by each country. I mean, what Barry Wynne says about freedom of speech, and it's perhaps a line taken by many other academics in his position, is to say that he, as a vice-chancellor, is not in the country to express a political view. I mean, what he does say, he does talk about academic freedom, but he's got a definition of it which is perhaps slightly different to how it might be envisaged, say, in the UK. He says if you're an economist, you should be able to comment on the economy without fear. So there's very much academic freedom within those disciplines. That broader definition of freedom of speech is something, not really saying, you know, there isn't that in Amman, but it's certainly saying that's not something that he's getting into as a university leader.
Okay, and Amman has quite an interesting approach. There's only one public institution, but they want to grow the number of private universities there.
Yeah, I mean, again, when people think about development of higher education in the in the Gulf region. A lot of people think about the branch campus model that we've seen, particularly, I suppose, Qatar, Abu Dhabi and Dubai following that route, sort of importing that expertise in the hope that sort of that allows for sort of very swift development and sort of a trickle-down effect into, you know, local institutions. I mean, the critique of that, and it's one that I think Barry Wynn subscribes to, is that those international providers bringing them in can be quite expensive, and it can be quite a, well, I guess there's a question about how long-term the commitment is on the part of those international providers. In Oman, yeah, there's one public institution, but then a lot of private universities, or at least a growing number of private universities, Sohar University is one of them, and it's hoped that by having locally rooted institutions with sort of local investors sort of putting money into them, it'll be a more long-term sustainable solution than relying on outsiders who could pull out at any time.
Okay, it sounds fascinating. Yeah, it's a really interesting interview, and it raises lots of questions for how Western universities can engage in the Middle East. Now, Karen, what's in the book section this week?
This week we have our fortnightly shelf life feature, in which I feature an academic, generally someone of high profile who has a new important book out this week, Deborah Brodigham, who is a professor of international political economy at Johns Hopkins and an expert on China's involvement in Africa. Her latest book, Will China Feed Africa, makes the case actually that despite what many people think, the amount of investment by China in Africa, the supposition people have that, you know, they're approaching their engagement in Africa as a way to bring food back to China and use it as some kind of breadbasket, isn't the case. So I asked Deborah about books she has read. She studied in Taiwan and Hong Kong early in her career, and she said that when she was learning Chinese, she fell for the poets of the Tang Dynasty, Li Po, Wang Wei, and Wei Yingwu, mostly because they left home, drank a lot of wine and climbed mountains, and she says as a foreign student she could really identify with that. Also this week, Les Gofton from Durham is reviewing an interesting guide to ethnographic observation by Christina Nippert-Eng, who makes the interesting case that you can extrapolate from her studies of observing animals, in this case gorillas, and these are rules or approaches that will work for observing people. Obviously, typically ethnography and anthropology is separate to animal behavior. Gofton doesn't quite buy it, however he does say there's a lot in the book that's useful for beginning researchers, just he's not quite sure that you can gather data from gorillas the same way you can from people. Also this week, Catherine Besteman's book, Making Refuge, Somali Bantu Refugees in Lewiston, Maine, is an interesting study of, well, as the title suggests, refugees who've come to a small former mill town on the East Coast, and she looks at how they are accepted, and our reviewer, Faith Nibbs, who comes from that part of the world, says that she grew up in New England and remembers a time when people who were coming from 2 hours away in Massachusetts were greeted with great suspicion for their foreignness. But interestingly enough, the small town virtues that people in Lewiston say they support, families helping each other and so on, dovetail quite closely, in fact, with the Somali refugees. So there may be fewer points of disagreement than originally suspected. Also this week, Candida Moss from the University of Notre Dame, young scholar of the New Testament, looks at a book that you could posit as a sacred history for atheists, Tim Whitmarsh's book, Battling the Gods, Atheism in the Ancient World, which looks at atheists from a long time ago and sees how they may dovetail with the Richard Dawkinses of today. The answer is, in some cases, yes, in other cases, no. But this week's book of the week, deservedly so, and you may have seen it many other places, is an astonishing, beautifully written, heart-wrenching book by a Stanford academic and neurosurgeon, now a late academic, Paul Kalanithi, his book When Breath Becomes Air, writing about his battle with cancer. Of course, battle with cancer is the worst kind of cliche. For those who fear cancer memoirs and think they are heart-wrenching with no insight beyond just feeling bad, this is a beautifully written book. He studied literature at university originally before he decided to pursue the biological strings executing this magic of creativity. I include an excerpt this week of Kalanithi in the anatomy lab and looking at the academics around him, some of whom end up leaning on the faces of the donor bodies they are dissecting, and another who looks at a body of someone who's died of pancreatic cancer and says, "How old is this fellow?" Someone says 74, and the professor says, "That's my age," and he put down the probe and walked away.
Gosh.
It's a wonderful book. I can't recommend it highly enough. Paul Kalanithi's When Breath Becomes Air, published by the Bodley Head.
That will sound brilliant. Thank you very much, Karen. Well, that's all we've got time for this week's review. Of course, in the magazine and online, you can find far more news, features, opinions, more books, and all kinds of other things. So do go to timeshighereducation.com, and you can find us on Facebook, LinkedIn, and Twitter. Until next week, goodbye.
You're listening to a Times Higher Education podcast.